Today we will be carrying on with our trek through the Satipatthana Sutta. And we're getting fairly far through it now, actually. So we had the section on the body, we had the section on Vedana yesterday. Today we're going to cover the third Satipatthana, which is on mind states, and we're going to make a start on the fourth Satipatthana. So there's quite a bit to get through. As a result of that, I'll just take questions at the end rather than as we go through each practice, because as I'm sure you've noticed, some of the Q&A sessions are getting a bit involved, and if I do those after every practice, then we're never going to finish the discourse. So we'll go through a few practices. We've got a guided one to play with a bit later on, and then we'll see how we get on. I just realized I forgot to say, actually, for anyone who's been tracking the original practices in the Satipatthana, mindfulness of the parts of the body is the original one from the first Satipatthana. Vedana, there's only one practice, so that's original. Third Satipatthana, again, there's only one practice, mind states, that's original as well. And we'll find out what's happening in the fourth Satipatthana as we get there. So, third Satipatthana. Mindfulness of mind states, or mindfulness of mind, you usually see it described as, but mind states is probably more useful. So, what does the discourse have to say? And how does one, in regard to the mind, abide contemplating the mind? Here, one knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. One knows an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. One knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. One knows a contracted mind to be contracted, and a distracted mind to be distracted. One knows a great mind to be great, and a narrow mind to be narrow. One knows a surpassable mind to be surpassable, and an unsurpassable mind to be unsurpassable. One knows a concentrated mind to be concentrated and an unconcentrated mind to be unconcentrated. One knows a liberated mind to be liberated and an unliberated mind to be unliberated. So, a lot of the practices that we've looked at so far, body scan, breath, elements, and so forth, focused on immediate sensations. What's here right now, right this very moment? What am I feeling in the tip of my index finger? What sensations do I feel in the contact between my feet and the floor? That kind of thing. As we move into the third Satipatthana, we're taking a bit of a step back. We're looking over a broader span of time. Mind states are mental factors which condition experience over time. There's no particular sensation of distractedness. There's no particular sound or thought that is distractedness. What you notice is that, oh, for the last few minutes, my mind's been wandering quite a lot. I'm in a distracted state. So, yeah, there may be individual things that tip us off. Maybe there's an angry thought that comes along that can tip us off. But really, we're talking about things that sustain a bit more. If one little blip of anger comes and goes, you're not really in an angry mind state. But if you've been thinking about that thing your boss did for the last 10 minutes, then yeah, that's a mind state. Knowing your mind state is a very valuable thing. If you realize that you're in a particularly angry or turbulent mind state, then, for example, that might be a clue that it's not a good state in which to make long-term life decisions. It can be quite helpful to notice, it seems like everything is more annoying than usual today. Oh, I'm in an aversive mind state. It's not that actually your co-workers are out to get you. It's that you got out of bed on the wrong side this morning and everything's just annoying you a little bit too much. Now, in the third Satipatthana, we're not necessarily doing anything about our mind states yet. We're just noticing. So it's not like you notice, you know your mind to be distracted and then you fix it or something. No, you just know that your distracted mind is a distracted mind. Now we have this big list of states, and the terms aren't really explained. You know, you've heard the whole list, and as a result, as with any good list of words, when they're not really explained, there's all kinds of possible interpretations and commentaries and so forth. Some of them are fairly obvious, some of them not so much. The first three, we have the three poisons, slightly in a different guise. We have lust, anger, and delusion, and that's greed, hatred, and delusion. So you recognize the presence or absence of each of the three poisons in your mind state. Are you in a greedy, a lustful mind state? Are you in an angry or hateful mind state? Are you in a deluded mind state? Now, being in a greedy mind state, being in a hateful mind state, those are relatively easy to notice, right? You start to notice a stream of being drawn towards something, that's greed, or a stream of aversion of wanting to get rid of something, and that's hatred. But delusion is a tricky one. What does it feel like to be wrong? The answer is it feels exactly the same way that it feels to be right until the moment you find out you're wrong. Because if it felt different to be wrong, then you wouldn't be wrong about things, right? So, yeah, knowing whether you're deluded or not, that one is tricky. One way that we can look at this is whether what we're doing is in line with our deeper insights. Are we acting in the world in a way that actually makes sense to us on the basis of what we've experienced in our path? And if we're not, then yeah, maybe there's a bit of delusion creeping in. Next, we have knowing the mind to be a contracted mind to be contracted and a distracted mind to be distracted. So I interpret these as referring to dullness and restlessness. So the contraction it's talking about is that kind of when everything sort of shrinks down. If you think about sort of a flower that opens its petals and then it contracts again as it's kind of going to sleep. It could be that contraction could mean something like getting really tight around your object of meditation, but that's more likely to lead to distraction and restlessness, actually, and distraction is a separate one. So I tend to interpret these two as dullness and restlessness. And again, this is a good thing to notice. If your mind is getting dull, if you're going into that sinking downward kind of place, you need to perk yourself up a little bit, inject a bit of energy into what's going on. If things are getting a bit distracted, a bit restless, then yeah, it may mean that you need to just chill out a little bit, calm things down, reduce the energy level. Then we have this bit about knowing a great mind to be great and a narrow mind to be narrow. This could be a reference to maybe the size of your current attentional focus, what I sometimes call the scope of your concern. How big or small, whatever it is you're occupying yourself with right now. So sometimes in meditation practice, we're open quite broadly. We're looking around, we're open to our whole sensory experience. Sometimes we're more focused on a particular aspect, like yesterday when we were doing mindfulness of the Vedana of sounds. And knowing whether you're in a great or a narrow attentional focus is an important thing because there's a time and a place for each. If you're trying to do deep work that requires a lot of very precise focus, then being relatively narrowly focused is probably helpful, whereas if half of you is listening to the conversation that's happening behind you, that isn't going to be so useful. But if you're trying to cross a busy street with a lot of traffic and you're narrowly focused on the interesting podcast you're listening to in your ears, yeah, that's not going to go that well for you. So knowing great and a narrow mind state and understanding the time and place for each. Then we have this knowing a surpassable mind to be surpassable and an unsurpassable mind to be unsurpassable. That could be I've seen this interpreted as, well, are you fully awakened or not? I mean, if you're fully awakened, that's presumably an unsurpassable mind state. But yeah, that doesn't seem that useful as a practice. I mean, you know, it's, am I fully enlightened? Nope. Well, okay, done that one. It doesn't seem that interesting. Sometimes in the suttas, you find people talking about they're in one of the jhanas and then they realize, oh, but this is a surpassable mind state. There's further we can go. And so then they leave that jhana and they move on to the next one. So there could be something about that. It could alternatively be just something like a sense of, Is this as good as it gets, or is there more available here? So sometimes, you start a practice, you start doing a metta practice, let's say, and you get it going, but it's just kind of ticking along. And yeah, you've had metta that's better than this. There's something that's not quite gelling yet, and you can stay with it and build it. So you have a sense that your metta practice is currently surpassable. You can do better metta than this. And then at some point you get to, yeah, this is what it's like, actually. This is my unsurpassable metta. One knows a concentrated mind to be concentrated and an unconcentrated mind to be unconcentrated. I think we all have experiences of that on this retreat. And one knows a liberated mind to be liberated and an unliberated mind to be unliberated. And this can be interpreted in terms of freedom from the three poisons again, but not just looking at them one at a time, but as a whole. Is my mind currently in the grip of one or more of the three poisons? Is it an unliberated mind state? Or are they absent? Are we in actually a mind state that's liberated from the three poisons? And that can be a momentary experience. It can be longer. Maybe at some point we'll get to the place where actually we're fully liberated from the three poisons and they don't come back. We'll find out, I guess. And of course, we have the refrain in this way in regard to the mind. One abides contemplating the mind internally, externally, in both, contemplating the nature of arising, passing away in both, and mindfulness that there is a mind is established in oneself to the extent necessary for bare knowledge, continuous mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to the mind, one abides contemplating the mind. So internally, externally, in both. As you look at your mind states, you start to see how your own mind states condition your behavior. And then you can see the same in other people as well. Other people are prone to mind states. I think we all know this one, right? We all have that sense, oh, so-and-so is in a mood. I'd better stay out of their way today. We get what that's like. Arising, passing, and impermanence, we can see that mind states are impermanent. The way you feel now is not how it's always going to be. Mind states come and go just like anything else. Even your most beautiful, peaceful, glorious, spiritual feeling mind state, yeah, that's just another experience. That's going to come along, and then it's going to hang around for a bit, and then it's going to go away again. That is the nature of mind states. They arise and they pass away. Perhaps the most important bit of this one is the piece about bare knowledge. So this is not a practice about gathering evidence for what a terrible meditator you are. It's not, oh, yeah, I'm in a contracted mind state. Oh, yeah, I'm in a greedy mind state. Oh, yeah, I'm in an unconcentrated mind state. Man, I suck at this. That's not what it's about. It's about just bare knowledge, noticing what's going on in the mind. Like I said before, we're not going to do anything about it necessarily in terms of the third Satipatthana. That will come a little bit later. For now, it's just about getting familiar with our own mind states. How do we know we're in a particular mind state? What is it like to be contracted versus not contracted? What is it like to be greedy versus not? And so on and so forth. So that is the third Satipatthana, mindfulness of mind states. And what this is doing really is it's inviting us to build a kind of, you might call it something fancy like metacognitive awareness, but really it's about knowing ourselves better. It's about having a sense of what's going on with me right now. What is my mind state and how is that coloring my experience? And you can notice how different mind states color the experience in different ways. And you can see you can see what you're bringing to the table in terms of each experience. Every experience we have is a coming together of lots of things, and we bring some of those things with us. So yeah, the third Satipatthana allows us to explore some of that. So then moving on into the fourth Satipatthana, and this is mindfulness of dharmas. Now, Lee's already talked about this, but just to recap, Dharma with a capital D is usually the teaching of the Buddha. Dharmas with a little d in plural usually means phenomena. Dharma can also mean something like law, in the sense of a law of physics, the way something operates, something like that. And really all of those meanings are intended here. There might be a bit of a kind of play on words going on here. Apparently that happens quite a lot in the suttas if you know Pali very well, but I don't know Pali very well, so it just goes straight over my head. But yeah, early Buddhism is notorious for its lists. And we've had a bit of discussion in some of the Q&A about some of these lists and why there's so many and there's so many things that you seem to have to know and all that stuff. And after a while, it can make early Buddhism seem a bit like a physics textbook. You know, there's all this stuff to memorize and it's all very abstract and theoretical. And oh, what's the point of it? And I never liked physics anyway. Oh, God. So the nice thing about this section of the Satipatthana Sutta is that it's going to give us some practices to make these things real. So I would say that all of these lists that we're getting, all of these things, all of these models about how experience works and this leads to that and so on and so on and so on, it's not about somebody very clever has figured out what your experience is built out of, and now they're going to teach it to you, and somehow that will be helpful. And so you just have to memorize it and learn to recite it. I don't think, yeah, if you can rattle off the 12 links of dependent origination off the top of your head without any notes, that's kind of impressive on some level. But has it really made a difference to your life, or is it given you a sort of Buddhist party trick to impress your meditation friends? For me, this stuff really comes alive when it actually starts to mean something. You can learn all about wavelengths of light and how it diffracts through the atmosphere, and it's sort of maybe technically interesting on an intellectual level. And then you can go and watch a beautiful sunset, and you can feel it, and you can really experience it deeply. And for me, all of these lists and technicalities and things, they only really come alive when it's something that we can actually practice with, when it's something real in our experience. So as we go through the fourth Satipatthana, we're going to find just all the lists. Every list you can think of is crammed into the fourth Satipatthana somewhere. But it's not just, here's a list of 10 things to learn, here's a list of 6 things to learn. It's, here's a list of things, and here's how you practice with it. So the first practice in the section is the five hindrances. Now, Lee's given a talk about the hindrances already, so I'm not going to explain what they are, but I'll just say what it says and how the practice goes. So how does one, in regard to dharmas, abide contemplating dharmas? Here, in regard to dharmas, one abides contemplating dharmas in terms of the five hindrances. And how does one, in regard to dharmas, abide contemplating dharmas in terms of the five hindrances? If sensual desire is present in oneself, one knows there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in oneself, one knows there is no sensual desire in me. And one knows how unarisen sensual desire can arise, how arisen sensual desire can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed sensual desire can be prevented. And then we have the same form of words for aversion, for sloth and torpor, for restlessness and remorse, and for doubt. So you start with something that's very much like what we were seeing in the third Satipatthana. You know whether or not a hindrance is present. You recognize, yeah, this hindrance is present in me, or no, it's not. But then we start getting into conditionality. We're starting to learn something more valuable about our experience now. We're invited to learn how the unarisen hindrance can arise. How do our unwholesome states come to be? What triggers them? What sets them off? We're to investigate how an arisen hindrance can be removed. So how do we get ourselves out of this mess once we find ourselves in it? Because we're not going to catch it every time. We're going to sometimes, yeah, find ourselves in the grip of a hindrance. How do we get out of it? And how a future arising of the removed hindrance can be prevented. So how do we make it less likely that we'll get caught in the same trap in the future? So, do people know the four great efforts? Or is that not something people are that familiar with? Seeing a few head shakes. All right, so let's just talk about this. So we have the Eightfold Path. The sixth step on the Eightfold Path is right effort. And right effort is often explained in terms of the four great efforts. The first great effort is to prevent the arising of an unwholesome state. So maybe you know that if you don't eat breakfast, then by about 11 o'clock in the morning, you're going to start to get grumpy. You're going to get hangry. You know that word? You're not going to be a nice person to be around. And so, yeah, you eat breakfast every morning, and that prevents the arising of an unwholesome state. You've eaten enough food, your body's feeling happy, no mid-morning grumpiness for you. Second great effort is to cause an arisen unwholesome state to cease. So maybe one day you're traveling, you're out and about, you don't have time for breakfast, you get to 11 o'clock, everyone's being a little bit more annoying than usual, I see what's going on here, didn't have breakfast, I've gotten a bit grumpy. And so you eat something, and your body calms down, and you're not so grumpy anymore. You have caused an arisen, unwholesome state to cease. Third of the great efforts is to cause an unarisen, wholesome state to rise. So we're pivoting from the unwholesome to the wholesome. And now we're saying, yeah, okay, how do we make a wholesome state arise? So you sit down to do your meditation, and you may be a bit tired, and you're a bit fed up, and it hasn't been going that well lately, and you're in just a bit of a kind of, can't really be bothered with this. Yeah, a wholesome state has not yet arisen. But what do we invite people to do at the start of the sit? Well, things like gratitude, things like metta, these put us in a pleasant mind state, in a wholesome mind state. And so we think, all right, fine, I'll give it a go. I'll do a little bit of metta. And a few minutes later, yeah, actually, you're starting to feel pretty good. You have caused an unarisen, wholesome state to arise. And the fourth great effort, you maintain and bring to perfection an arisen, wholesome state. So maybe you're doing a little bit of metta at the start of your practice, and it's kind of going, you know, you've got a dribble of metta coming out of the tap, but yeah, you know, you can do better. And so you stay with it, you nurture it, you nourish it, you open the tap a little bit wider, and now it's flowing, and now you're in, yeah, this is much nicer, this is a much deeper, much fuller, wholesome state. You have maintained it and deepened it. I'm nervous about language like bring to perfection, because it triggers the perfectionists in some of us, but yeah, you've certainly very much deepened that wholesome state. So these are the four great efforts: to prevent the arising of an unwholesome state, such as a hindrance, and to cause an arisen unwholesome state, such as a hindrance, to cease. And so these are the two of the four that we see in the practice with the hindrances, because the hindrances are unwholesome states, right? And so we want to prevent them from coming up. And if they have come up, then we want to find a way to get them to cease. The second two of the great efforts, the ones relating to wholesome states, we'll see those, a practice relating to those, tomorrow when we get on to the seven factors of awakening. So this is the practice. It's about noticing your hindrances, studying them to understand what sets them off, figuring out how to let go of them, how to work your way out of them, and determining how to avoid them in the future. This can be a really big deal. If you find yourself repeatedly in habits of behavior that lead nowhere particularly helpful, then really studying those, learning what sets them off. If I'm trying to lose weight, then I have learned over time that it's a bad idea to have my wallet with me at work, because we have a shop and it sells lots of chocolate and no apples or anything remotely healthy. And if I have my wallet at work and it's a stressful day, before I know it, I'm going to have maybe not a mountain of chocolate wrappers on my desk, although sometimes. But yeah, there's going to be some food consumed which is not going to help in my attempt to lose weight. I can fix that pretty easily if I don't take my wallet to work. Then as much as I might like to go and stand in the shop and look at all the nice things, I can't buy any because I haven't got any money. The only thing I have to do there is when a friend sees me standing there looking despondent and says, oh, I can lend you some money. No, that's not the point. That's not the point. I'm trying to... You get the idea. And of course, again, we have the refrain in regard to dharmas. One abides contemplating dharmas, internally, externally, in both. So yeah, I have hindrances, you have hindrances, we all have hindrances. This is a lot like the more unwholesome mind states in the mind state practice. And we all have our own ways as well. We all have things that trigger hindrances, and they're different from person to person. We all have our own individual ways of wriggling out of the hindrances as well. Arising, passing, and impermanence. Hindrances come and go just like everything else. Sometimes when you're on a retreat and you're in the grip of aversion or doubt or something, and it's been that way for a while, it can start to feel like this is how it's always going to be. But it's not. They come and go just like anything else. And again, as with the previous one, bare knowledge. It's about learning. It's not about self-flagellation. It's not about finding evidence to criticize ourselves with. It's about learning our patterns and learning to work with those and trying to move ourselves in a more wholesome direction. So that's the practice with the five hindrances. And then the next one, and the last one we're going to talk about today, because this is the one that we're going to do a practice with, is the five aggregates. Now, this is one that we've talked a little bit about already. The five aggregates have come up a few times. And as Lee gets more into some of the dependent origination talks, a lot of the concepts of the aggregates and things like that will be coming up more and more in the talks. And yeah, as things get more technical, like I was saying earlier, it's very helpful to have an experiential sense of what some of these words mean, so that it isn't just a barrage of abstract technical terms. I've done my very best with the language here. So for the most part, I'm sticking with Anaglio's translation of the Satipatthana Sutta. But for the five aggregates, I've changed it so that the language is more in line with the way Lee translates these terms. And it's more in line with what you'll find if you get his book on dependent origination, the Sotapai book. And that's basically just to try to avoid confusion when we're moving between different teachers as much as possible. Yeah, it's confusing enough already without us translating the words different ways. I'm sure there's still a few going to slip through the net one way or another, but yeah, we're doing our best. So what's the practice for the five aggregates? Again, in regard to dhammas, one abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the five aggregates of clinging. And how does one, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas in terms of the five aggregates of clinging? Here one knows, such is materiality, form, rupa. Such is materiality, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is Vedana, pleasantness, valence, feeling turn. Such is Vedana, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is conceptualization, sanya, perception, labeling. Such its arising, such its passing away. Such are mental activities, sankharas, fabrications, mental formations. Such are mental activities, such their arising, and such their passing away. Such is consciousness, vijnana. Such its arising, such its passing away. So we've got these five aggregates, and the first time I encountered this list, I was like, this is a weird list, and then I just kind of moved on and forgot about it. And it took a long time, really, for this to become something meaningful for me. The aggregates are categories of subjective experience. It's another way of dividing our experience up into categories which collectively comprise our subjective experience. We can also use the aggregates to look in terms of our sense of self, and we'll be doing that a little bit later on. But in the broadest sense, the aggregates, these are the five. So the first one, rupa, materiality. Physical body, physical world, things composed of the four great elements, to go back a few days. Things you can kick, the stuff of the world. And this is the stuff that we've been examining through the practices of the first Satipatthana. So in terms of the self, we have the body. The body is pretty key to our identity, to our sense of who we are. Second aggregate, Vedana. Lee likes valence. I sometimes say pleasantness. It's this quality of how it feels to us. Is this a pleasant experience? Is it an unpleasant experience? Is it neutral? Is it neither pleasant nor unpleasant? Is it something that we just don't really have a strong opinion about? It's somewhere in the middle. And this is the realm of the second Satipatthana, which is all about Vedana. And obviously, again, the things we like, the things we don't like, these are individual to us. I know, for example, there are people in the world who think aniseed is really repulsive, and there are people in the world who are wrong. We each have different tastes when it comes to things like flavors and so on and so forth. What's pleasant to me may be unpleasant to you, and vice versa. And as we explore the world and as we learn what things are consistently pleasant for us and what things are consistently unpleasant, we start to build up a sense of our preferences. We start angling towards the things we like and away from the things that we don't. And so our Vedana developing into our preferences, that again becomes a core part of who we are and how we are in the world. Third aggregate is Sanya. You most often see perception, but Lee's going to translate it as conceptualization. And it's this kind of labeling process. It's if Vedana is how something feels, Sanya is what the thing is. This is a door, this is a chair, this is a window, this is a cat, and so on and so forth. And again, we each have our own set of concepts. We accumulate them over the course of our lives, and we probably forget a few along the way as well. The set of concepts that we have determines the way that we see the world to a certain extent. If you spent a lot of time learning a lot of detail about something, then you'll have a much richer experience of that than someone who really doesn't know anything about it. I used the guitar amp example the other day. If I walk into a guitar shop and there's all these different amplifiers and there's all these different guitars, and that one's got three pickups and there's all these details that are very relevant and interesting to me. Whereas for other people, it's just a shop full of chunks of wood with metal strings attached. It's just there's not a lot going on there. And so our set of concepts kind of develops into something of a worldview, right? The way in which we see the world, the terms in which we understand what's going on around us. And yeah, if you've ever met somebody who has a wildly different worldview to you, who relates to the world in terms of totally different concepts, then you start to get a sense of how differently we can see things depending on the concepts that we're using. The fourth aggregate, sankhara, this tricky word, fabrications, concoctions. In the context of the aggregates, mental activities is Lee's preference. You often see mental formations. And basically, this covers things like, first of all, our intentions, volitions. So our sense of agency, our sense of being able to form an intention to do something and carry it out. And also our impulses, what it occurs to me to do in response to something. You know, I see a bar of chocolate and the impulse to eat it occurs to me, that kind of thing. So there's this sense of being a decision-making agent, of having some independent agency in the world. That's part of this sankhara aggregate. But then there's also things like thoughts and emotions, the way we react to the world, the way we respond, and also memories. You know, as we live our lives, we accumulate memories. We build this into the story of who we are, or at least who we've been up to this point. And so all of these sort of more complex mental activities, these all belong in the sankhara aggregate. And these are the things that develop into what we might call maybe our personality or our character, the sort of person we are. So it's not so much about how we see the world, but it's the way we respond to it. And again, of course, the sort of person we are is an important part of our sense of identity. And then the fifth one is vijnana, consciousness. I might say consciousness of, because consciousness is one of those words that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and in different spiritual traditions, it's used wildly differently. So here's a very simple example. So I have in my hand a packet of tissues, and you can see it, and so you are conscious of the packet of tissues that I have, right? This is in your present limit experience, you have consciousness of my packet of tissues. Now, going to put them back in my pocket. You can't see the packet of tissues anymore, so you no longer have eye consciousness of the packet of tissues. But it was recently enough that you still remember that I have them and I'm still talking about them, so you probably haven't forgotten about them yet. So you still have mind consciousness of the packet of tissues. You know it exists, you know it's there, even though you can't see it. And then at some point, you'll forget I ever had a pack of tissues. The talk will move on. We'll get into the practice maybe. And you will no longer be conscious of the packet of tissues at all. That will be gone from your experience. You will have no consciousness of a packet of tissues. So that's the sense in which consciousness is meant in the aggregates. It's not talking about some kind of immortal soul. It's not talking about some kind of unconditioned awareness or some of these other ideas that we encounter. It's consciousness of, it's knowing what's present in your experience right now. And yeah, this ability to know what's going on is pretty important, right? It's one of the key things that distinguishes living beings from unliving beings. We tend to think that, yeah, rocks probably don't really know what's going on around them, whereas people and animals do. Knowing makes quite a big difference. It's quite fundamental to what makes us alive. There's a little formula in Anália's book on the Satipatthana that I quite like for giving us a way to remember the five aggregates in a nutshell. And I think he got it from another teacher, actually, and I can't remember who, but anyway. It's, so you're walking along and you encounter something, and it's a tall, solid, pleasant, shady tree for lying under that I can see. So it's a hot day, you're out for a walk, you're kind of sweating, you come across this tree, it's tall and it's solid. This is its materiality, its form. It's composed of the four great elements, and you're mainly noticing the earth element there. It's tall, it's solid, rupa, form, materiality. Oh, and it's shady as well. Yeah, it's a tall, solid, that's the rupa bit. It's pleasant. It's a hot day, you're sweating, you want to get out of the glare of the sun for a bit. Hey, there's a tree. Oh, that's quite nice. That's pleasant. Pleasant vedana. Pleasant valence, pleasant quality to experience. It's a shady tree. That's the conceptualization part. That's the labeling. You recognize that it's a tree. You know, the sign is maybe, I don't know, it's tall and it's got some leaves or something. Maybe one of its secondary characteristics is that it's casting a nice patch of shade underneath it. And you know, that's going to be nice and cool to rest in for a while. So that's your sanya. That's your conceptualization. You recognize this tall, solid, pleasant thing as a shady tree. And because you're hot and because it's shady and it's pleasant, you think, yeah, I could lie under that for a while. That would be nice. That's a sankhara. It's a mental activity. It's coming up in response to the situation. You're having maybe an impulse. Wouldn't it be nice to lie down under this tall, solid, pleasant, shady tree to get out of the sun for a bit? And of course, it's a tall, solid, pleasant, shady tree for lying under that you can see. That's the consciousness. That's the vijnana. If you couldn't see it, you might be imagining a very nice, tall, solid, pleasant, shady tree. You might be thinking, oh, it'd be lovely to lie under a tree like that. But until you can actually see it, it's not that much use. But when you see it, you become conscious of a real, material, tall, solid, pleasant, shady tree for lying under that you can see. So that's the five aggregates in a nutshell. And of course, we have the inevitable refrain. One is to contemplate the aggregates internally, externally, and universally. Again, yeah, these things are common to all people, to all life on some level. We're also to contemplate these arising, passing away, and both. And in this practice in particular, you'll notice that for nearly all the other practices, the arising and passing, it's mentioned in the refrain, but it's not a core part of the instructions. So we'll talk about, you know, mindful one breathes in, mindful one breathes out. And then when you get to the refrain, it talks about being mindful of the body, arising and passing, and so forth. But in this one, it's right there in the instructions. Here one knows, such is materiality, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is Vedana, such its arising, such its passing away, and so on and so forth. So we're really being directed here, not just to look at the five aggregates, but really to focus on the impermanent quality. Why is that important? Well, because our sense of self is strongly bound up in these various different aspects of our experience, as we start to recognize that each of these things is impermanent, we start to realize, we start to gather evidence for the recognition that there really isn't a solid, stable place for a permanent, fixed sense of self. It's all flow, it's all change, it's all sodapai, like Lee was saying the other night. Now, I'm not going to bang on about this too long myself because, yeah, while I'm just talking about it, it's potentially still just a theoretical thing. And we had quite a long discussion about it in the Q&A last night as well. So you've heard the theory already. What we're going to do now is do some practice with it. So we're going to do a guided contemplation on the five aggregates. And we're going to look at them in terms of the three characteristics. So we'll look at the impermanent qualities. We'll look at whether each of these aggregates is reliable, dependable as a source of lasting happiness. And we'll look at whether the aggregate is fully under our control, whether it always does what we want it to do, whether it's really mine or me to the point that we have complete determination over it, or whether each of these aggregates, yeah, seems to have a bit of a mind of their own. So we'll go through each one in turn, and like the other contemplations, I'll drop in various probes, various things to explore as we're going through each one. So let's just give this a go for the next 25 minutes or so, and just see where we go with it. Oh, actually, sorry, let's take 5 minutes to get concentrated first, and then we'll spend about 25 minutes on the contemplation. So, yeah, if you'd be willing, setting yourself up for meditation and just taking the next 5 minutes or so to get concentrated. First aggregate, rupa, materiality. Notice that you have a body with various qualities and capabilities. If you had a different body with different qualities and capabilities, would you be a different person? Notice that your body's qualities and capabilities change over time due to age, exercise, injury, and so on. Is your body a reliable source of pleasure? Could it ever be? Does your body always do what you want it to? Or does it ever let you down? Second aggregate, Vedana. Notice that you experience things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And over time, you learn your preferences in this regard. If you had very different tastes and preferences, would you be a different person? Notice that your likes and dislikes change over time. Things which used to be unpleasant can become pleasant, and vice versa. Are your preferences a reliable source of pleasure? Could they ever be? Can you choose only to have pleasant experiences all the time? Third aggregate, Sanya, conceptualization. Notice that you understand the world through concepts, which you've learned and developed over the course of your life, forming your worldview, your sense of what things mean. If you had a very different worldview, would you be a different person? Notice that your concepts change over time. As you have new experiences, you learn new concepts, and over time you forget old ones. Are your concepts a reliable source of pleasure? Could they ever be? Can you control which concepts you pick up from your environment? Can you choose to forget an unwanted concept? Fourth aggregate, Sankhara, mental activities. Notice that you have various intentions, impulses, thoughts, emotions, memories, reactions. And over time, you learn to identify your character traits and your life story in terms of these. If you had very different character traits or a different life story, would you be a different person? Notice that your mental activities change over time. On this retreat, we're cultivating loving kindness so that our instinctive responses become kinder. Are your mental activities a reliable source of pleasure? Could they ever be? Can you control what mental activities arise within you? Do you always follow through on the intentions that you set? Do you always refrain from acting on unhelpful impulses? Fifth aggregate, vijnana, consciousness. Notice that you are conscious of all sorts of events and phenomena throughout the day. If you had very little consciousness, or none at all, would that make you a different person? Notice that your degree of consciousness changes over time. Sometimes you're very perceptive, sometimes absent-minded, sometimes asleep. Is your consciousness always a source of pleasure? Could it ever be? Can you always choose what you become conscious of?